This is Liberation Radio.
Capitalism needs poverty.
A world run by a handful of greedy bankers and CEOs who nobody elected can't possibly last.
Whatever we could do, we're gonna do, especially in continuing to preserve this earth.
Each week, we bring you interviews, commentary, analysis, political developments, and struggles affecting workers throughout the country as a way to build the movement for socialism in the United States.
The revolution will be broadcast.
The only thing that will ever defeat racism will be the defeat of its parents, capitalism and imperialism.
Without smashing mass incarceration, working people of all nationalities cannot have justice.
Liberation Radio is brought to you by the Party for Socialism and Liberation.
Welcome to Liberation Radio. I'm your host, Sean Garcia. On this episode, we discuss the increasing U.S. role in the Saudi bombing of Yemen. We hear voices from the movement to fight racist violence against Native people in New Mexico. But first, we speak with Sean Blackman of the Party for Socialism and Liberation in Washington, D.C., and also an organizer with the D.C. Ferguson Coalition. He talks about the concerted lies of the cops and the media around the police killing of Walter Scott. All right, Sean, so what do you think is the most notable point about the Walter Scott case?
I think the most notable thing about the Walter Scott incident is the reaction we saw from that North Charleston Police Department. Because if we contrast that with what we typically see with these extrajudicial killings, is that, the police will kill someone for a while. They may not even release the identity of the officer. And, sort of a little time goes by, and they're able sort of to get their story together about what supposedly happened. And then they, come out with, some narrative that justifies their killing. But, and sometimes this is even with video evidence, as we've seen with Eric Garner and Oscar Grant and just so many other people. But what separates the Walter Scott incident from that is that the officer that killed him actually faced some punishment for this killing. And the fact that we actually have video evidence, it actually mattered. Which typically isn't the case. And as we've seen, like some of those cases I mentioned, you have all the evidence in the world, and it still doesn't seem to make a difference. And not only did he go under that suspension without pay and things like that, it really seemed to me that everyone that was in any way associated with him or with the North Charleston Police Department really took a very hands-off approach to him. It's like no one would touch him, no one would vouch for him, no one was coming on TV or going on the news or on the radio saying how great an officer he was. I think some of his troublesome past in the force came to light, which is not something that usually happens. It seems like the only advocate the officer really had, was his own mother. His mother, went on TV and, was defending him, talking about how quality a person he was. But for those of us who have been keeping track of the police murder issue, I think we need to be very clear on why that was the response, on why that there was actually some repercussion for the killing of Walter Scott. And it's not because the North Charleston Police Department is a progressive police entity. Certainly not. What that was the North Charleston Police Department trying to avoid another Ferguson incident, another Ferguson type situation. What I mean by that is after you have this police killing, there's just this massive outrage, not just from the local people, but you also have activists and other people coming in from outside of the city where the incident took place that's helping to form this resistance. It's a PR nightmare. It puts a lot of pressure on not just the police department, but also the city government. And I think that police departments across America at this point are on notice, and are at a point where they would really just rather avoid that. So in order to avoid that, massive wave of protest and these dramatic images, that we saw come out of Ferguson, like the guy who was throwing the tear gas back at the police, and we see these militarized police with these high-powered weapons and these tanks and all of that, they want to be spared all of that. And I think that's the most notable difference.
So what do you think?
And it's not so much of the difference of the reaction, but also the reason why that there was the reaction that there was.
Right, exactly. And so what lessons do you think that, you know, activists around the country can learn from this incident, and what does it mean for the movement?
Well, that's an interesting question, because I don't think it will necessarily stoke any kind of new resistance or new movement, and I don't think it's going to have any negative impact either. What I think, if anything, it will do is to pretty much, for those of us who are already doing this work, it just serves as another example why we have to keep, you know, fighting this fight, and we have to keep moving in the streets and organizing, and not just merely demonstrating, but also organizing around concrete demands to how we can approach the issue of police terror in our communities where we're from. Because, of course, as we know, it's not just a Ferguson thing. Police murder is an issue all over this country, in cities big and small, even right here in the nation's capital, right? And in terms of the lessons, when I look at, because even in this this latest rash of police murder that we've seen, all these prominent cases, right? This is not the first time that we've seen some kind of restitution or some kind of something we may think of as a proper response to a police killing, and not necessarily just police killing, but also vigilante killings. If you look at the Renisha McBride case, the Jordan Davis case in Huntsville, and even in my hometown of Pensacola, Florida, an officer named Gerald R. ran over a 17-year-old kid named Victor Steen on camera, mind you, there's that camera thing again, and he was acquitted, but the city ended up settling with the family. And the point is that when we see these officers, or when we see the families of victims receiving some kind of justice, we can't be fooled into thinking that that means that there's progress taking place on the issue of police terror. Because that kind of thinking is just as flawed as this bad apple ideology that we see when we talk about this issue. That, you know, it's not, you know, that it's an issue of bad apples, it's these cops, you know, all this police terror is a series of unfortunate events. That's how it's been cast. A series of unfortunate events that, although they all have the same earmarks, the same characteristics, they're not connected. What we have to understand is that it's not a series of unfortunate events. The fact that some families receive a measure of justice for the loss of their loved ones is not a sign of progress, because it's not an individual issue. It's not about individual cops, and it's not about individual examples of families getting restitution. It's about understanding that police terror is a systemic issue, and it is endemic to the United States of America, and that it is a particular outgrowth, if you will. It's a particular characteristic, and a very important one, to America as a capitalist society. I mean, the police have a very particular role in capitalist society and the way that it deals with black people, and also, of course, you know, brown, red, yellow, and poor and oppressed people in general. We have to sort of think of it that way. If we look at it as, you know, from situation to situation, as an individual thing, then there can really never be a solution. You know what I mean? And that's why these bad apple ideologies are pushed so hard. Because if it's an issue of individual cops and it's not an issue of the system, well, then we can, you know, have the understanding that the system as it is just fine. Because right. If we don't, the moment that we admit that the system is the problem, and the power and immunity, really, that most police enjoy is a part of a systemic issue, once we admit that, then we have to admit that we need to change the system as it is. And that's really the analysis and the conversation that those in power really do not want to have.
All right, Sean, thank you so much. We'll keep following this case and still be out there in the streets.
All right, great. Thanks a lot, man.
You're tuned in to Liberation Radio, and you can check us out on our website, liberationradio.org, on Facebook at facebook.com/Liberation Radio Show, and on Twitter at the handle Liberation Radio. Jane Cutter, an editor of Liberation News and a leading member of the PSL, discusses the increased U.S. involvement in the Saudi bombing of Yemen, which began on March 25th. Okay, Jane, so how has the conflict progressed and what's been the role of the U.S.?
Well, as you know, the U.S. is increasing its role in the bombing campaign. One of the ways they're doing that is by essentially vetting the Saudi target list, and they've also moved to intercept alleged Iranian aid to the Houthi rebels. So what's interesting about this is that this increase in direct assistance to the Saudi bombing effort is really in contradiction to the Obama administration's stated desire for the Saudis to scale back the bombing campaign and only focus on halting the advances in order to force all parties back to the negotiating table. On the other hand, the Saudis have as their goal the complete destruction of the Houthis' military capability and the restoration of President Hadi, which many in the Obama administration believe is an unrealistic goal, given that more than 2 weeks of bombardment have failed to halt the Houthis, although they were driven out of Aden. So the thing is that the Obama administration's advocacy of a more limited bombing campaign is actually grounded in some understanding of what the reality is on the ground. So on the one hand, the Houthis are not universally popular in Yemen, but the Saudis are even less universally popular, especially considering that they're causing massive civilian casualties right now. So the reality is that the bombing campaign is ultimately likely to politically strengthen the Houthis and other anti-U.S. forces such as Al-Qaeda and the Arabic Peninsula and other groups of that nature. So the question is, if that's what the understanding of the administration is, why are they providing so much support to the bombing campaign? And, you know, they claim that they're going to try to help prevent civilian casualties by advising the Saudis, which seems laughable considering that the U.S. was involved in the drone attacks and extralegal assassination of U.S. citizens in Yemen. But I think what they really want to do is they want to limit the scope of civilian casualties and hold them down to a more modest number. And they've also made some very strong claims that Iran is providing military aid to the Houthis, but they've not really been able to prove it. They just keep saying, Kerry just says, we know they're doing it, we know they're doing it, but they don't have any proof. And when they went to intercept a Panamanian flagged ship at the beginning of April in the Red Sea, they came up empty-handed. So there's, you know, they haven't really been able to prove that, but they're definitely getting more involved in this Saudi campaign.
And what's the humanitarian impact of the Saudi campaign?
Well, it's really terrible. The country is in a horrible crisis. I think this is something that would illustrate it. There was a tweet that I saw from someone called Rouge129. To know what it is like in Yemen, turn off electricity, water, heating, eat once a day, fear for your life. I think that's very evocative. According to the Wall Street Journal, at least 648 civilians have been killed so far, many of these children. And the targets that they've been hitting have included refugee camps, hospitals, schools, urban neighborhoods, and even soccer stadiums. It's really a very dire situation where a lot of people don't have access to adequate food, adequate water, or adequate any kind of health care or treatment for their injuries.
And we've talked about it before, but can you go over again the nature of the Houthi forces?
Sure. They're a complicated group in a lot of ways. So they're originally from the north of the country. They do have some religious roots. Their religious affiliation is that there's Zaydi Shias. So Zaydism is a particular kind of Shia Islam only found in Yemen. And about 40% of Yemenis are Zaydi. So obviously not all Zaydis are in the Houthis. Okay. But the Houthis are all Zaydi. They are currently affiliated also with the former president, Ali Abdullah Saleh, who is himself Zaydi, although not from their tribal group, the same tribal group as the majority of the Houthis. They are alleged to be supported by Iran. So it's interesting that they're now blocking with Saleh, because Saleh, when he was president, was involved in trying to stop the Houthi rebellion, which has been going on for some time. Starting about September, they came down into Sana'a, the capital in the north, and basically took over and then really drove out the president and have been sort of in control of the central government apparatus since January. And then started moving to take over the rest of the country. I think that's an important thing to understand, is that controlling the central government does not in any way, shape, or form mean that you control all of the country. That's never been the case. Even under Ali Abdullah Saleh, he managed to be in control of the country through careful relationships with other sources of power, including tribal forces in different parts of the country. So it's always been a very weak central government, and the Houthis may hold government buildings, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they are the government or that they are controlling the entire country. And clearly right now there's a war going on over exactly who is even holding, who is in charge, to the extent that that means anything in any case.
Right. Well, we'll continue to keep following this conflict as it unfolds and definitely have you on again soon. Thanks so much, Jane.
Thank you.
And you can learn more about our ongoing coverage of the Yemen conflict by going to liberationnews.org.
Está el sol y la lluvia refresca. Desde desde el alba hasta la puesta es un ambiente ideal para sudar todo mal. Y nací en tierra agradecida donde crece casi todo lo que le tiras. Y puedo decir que en la isla hasta el que no tiene nada se puede alimentar aquí en tierra de poetas. El que no la sabe se la inventa.
Finally, we get to hear from the voices from the Red Nation as they rallied earlier this month against the extreme atmosphere of racist violence in Gallup, New Mexico. Hear the strong and courageous voices of the march organizers and participants who are fighting an ongoing struggle against racism against Native peoples.
Such as Maxine. Reason why we had this event today is because today is the first of the month. I mean, it's the first Saturday of the month. It's when everybody gets their GA checks or gets their monies, and they come into Gallup to pay off their loans, their high interest loans. At 7:30 in the morning on Saturday mornings, you'll see people at Colonial Pawn, the pawn shops, the payday loan centers lining up to pay their loans, and at the auto dealerships. So when we're talking about border town violence, we're not just talking about the actual acts of violence of people dying on the streets, but the ways in which the city extracts value, extracts profit from native people. And it depends, it's a dependence on Navajo generated business and native generated business. It's not the other way around. Indians don't depend on Gallup. Gallup depends on Indians. And so when we think of that, and when we think of that in the context of people who are saying, we need to humanize our relatives on the street. We don't need to humanize them. They're already human. The people who need to be humanized are those liquor store owners, the business.
Discriminated against, even though that's, you know, the only spot where they can get their groceries. And yeah, and so I invited my friend out and my mom, and it's their first time coming out to march and attend a rally of any sort. So I would encourage you guys to invite all your relatives out. And where should we take on next? Let's take on Farmington next. That'd be awesome. All right, thank you.
That's all for Liberation Radio. I'm Sean Garcia. Please remember, this program is available free for broadcast by community and public radio stations. You can encourage your local radio station to air Liberation Radio. They can visit liberationradio.org for details. And of course, tune in next week for more for the struggle for justice.
You have been listening to Liberation Radio, a weekly program from the Party for Socialism and Liberation. You can find us online at liberationradio.org to listen to past shows and connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Some of what you heard during this program are Creative Commons licensed compositions. Our theme music and some music segments were performed by Six Fingers and used with permission of the artists. Liberation Radio is produced by the Party for Socialism and Liberation to help build the struggle for socialism in the United States. The PSL is a party of activists and organizers. We are in the streets at the demonstrations and picket lines, opposing cutbacks and attacks on workers, standing up to police brutality, fighting for immigrant rights, and struggling against racism, sexism, homophobia, and all forms of bigotry. We stand in solidarity with oppressed peoples around the world resisting imperialism. We believe the crimes of capitalism call for a new kind of society, and we are committed to fighting for it. To find a PSL branch near you, see our upcoming events and learn more about how you can get involved. PSLweb.org. Again, that's PSLweb.org. Also, the PSL's Liberation newspaper online at liberationnews.org, where you can read our news articles and analysis or purchase a subscription to the print edition. Thank you for listening.